Thank you very much, and it was a privilege to listen to Miles' presentation before speaking, and also it does a lot of groundwork for what I want to say, that you've heard what Miles has to say, because much of what I'm saying is underpinned by the stuff that he presented in such a scholarly fashion. As well as these declarations of interest that I'm showing you here, it occurred to me as I was listening to Miles that one of the things that I've experienced that equips me to be able to talk about men and boys is that I grew up in a pub. And you probably learn more psychiatry in the front bar of a hotel than you do in medical school. These are the three things that I want to cover today. So I'll get on with doing that, really. Sorry, there was one other thing that I wanted to say that was set off by Miles' presentation, and hopefully we'll have a chance to take this up more in the discussion. I was thinking, as he was talking about the strength of attachment theory and its acceptance as underpinning a lot of the work that we do in psychotherapy and more broadly. But I think sometimes the brand of attachment theory that we're marketed is a bit problematic, because it's based on the idea that attachment theory is about forming nice relationships with other people, playing nicely together. And in fact, attachment theory comes out of the jungle. It's about how parents protect and keep their children safe under adversity. And so one of the things I think that about the version of attachment theory that's peddled is that it's a bit sanitized. And the other danger of attachment theory is that it's desexualized as well. And while it's understandable that people reacted against the kind of gross over emphasis of sexuality in Freudian theory, there is a certain way in which by adopting the approach to attachment theory that we have, that we've inappropriately desexualized men and women, de-genderized them to a certain extent as well. The conventional wisdom at the moment is that when children behave in a problematic fashion, that they're either being naughty or they're sick. And we in the medical profession have probably emphasized the latter over the former, thinking that we're doing a good thing to protect children from the stigma of being regarded as delinquent, and instead giving them the supposedly more positive status of being sick. I think in both of these exercises of labelling, we've failed children terribly, and I think that I don't just want to restrict myself to problematic behaviour that is delinquent or aggressive, although that will be the main emphasis. I also want to think about quieter problematic behaviour in boys. So perhaps if I start with some vignettes of the kinds of things I'm talking about, just three or four boys. One, a boy who's very bright, but has a receptive language disorder that nobody's recognised, so that most aspects of his school life are a breeze for him until his teacher starts to give complex verbal instructions. A second boy who has comes from a stable nuclear family, one of the last surviving ones, but has been subject to a refugee experience, and the family has been traumatized by the experience both of leaving their country of origin and also by the inhumane way in which they've been treated in Australia. And he remains somewhat preoccupied with the trauma that he's experienced. A third boy who's got a guts ache and who's also comes from a family where his parents constantly bicker and include him in that bickering. And the final boy, one who is going through mental experiences of which he can't make sense, intrusive thoughts and feelings and ideas that seem somewhat crazy to him, and he's not sure whether they're coming from inside his head or from somewhere else. So if we think about conceptualising those behaviours as illness, it's relatively easy to see the labels that could be attracted by those boys. The first one might be said to have ADHD because of his disruptive behaviour, secondary to his language disorder. The second one might be said to be depressed. The third one might be said to have a somatization disorder, and the fourth one might be said to be pre-psychotic. Now, we're not going to get rid of these kind of labels overnight. There is one little subversive thing that you can do just to detoxify the labels a little bit. If you replace disorder with reaction, you can sometimes get away with that without alienating people. So if you talk about attention deficit hyperactivity reaction, then you're smuggling into the process the idea that kids might be inattentive for a reason other than the fact that they've got some kind of disease or disorder. If you talk about a psychotic reaction, then you introduce meaning into otherwise meaningless behaviour. And so instead of thinking about any of those boys as being sick, let's try and think about them as communicating something about their predicament. I'm very influenced by a British child psychiatrist, David Taylor, who writes about unexplained signs and symptoms. This is you know, people who get physical symptoms that nobody can explain, and which he insists on calling hysteria. He says that one of the components to presenting with unexplained signs and symptoms. So examples would be chronic fatigue syndrome or a severe pain syndrome that doesn't have any good physiological explanation, or sometimes we see kids who go blind for no reason. So those kinds of presentation, he says, he reminds us that as well as having symptoms of a disease or an illness, we can have symptoms of a predicament. And from this point of view, think about how many symptoms the average boy has in a week, particularly a growing boy. And actually, there's been research done on this, and the average person has something like 30 unexplained symptoms a week. Think headaches, guts aches, diarrhea, nausea. If you kept a diary, it probably wouldn't be good for your health, but if you kept a diary, you'd find that probably you have a range of symptoms, whether it's from being stiff and sore after you've been for a run or whatever. Now, most of us pass over these symptoms with the fleeting thought that it might be cancer. but some people, and you can imagine the situation where your life is very restricted in some way emotionally, where you're under pressure, you can't resolve that pressure, your normal coping skills falter, and so that predicament that you're in manifests itself through physical symptoms. And sometimes, most commonly, parents will pass off those physical symptoms in a relatively benign way. But in two situations, that can become problematic. One, when the parent panics about the symptoms, my God, it must be cancer, we'd better get you to the hospital straight away. Or the second situation, where the parent is overly dismissive of the symptoms and says, you're having a lend of me, stop faking it, pull yourself together, and responds in a hostile fashion to it. And in both of those situations, we could see, imagine that kid being pressured towards pushing those symptoms forward. And then, this is where we come in as a medical profession and we can really screw things up. We come in and we make a diagnosis. Or more commonly, we don't make a diagnosis, but we get anxious about all kinds of possibilities. Or we say, these parents are anxious, so just to reassure them, we'll do a few tests. And of course, people aren't reassured by tests. If they're prone to health anxiety, they're panicked by tests. God, he must really be serious because he's sending me off for a CAT scan. And if the CAT scan comes back, well, normal, well, better have another one in a few months' time just to make sure it wasn't missed. So what we can see here is the potential evolution of this boy that I described earlier as abdominal pain into something that becomes an illness and then begins to have a treatment and an incapacitating effect on that child's life. Now, note that there's no suggestion here that the kid goes through any kind of thought process whereby he says, my way out of this is to exaggerate my guts up. These children aren't malingering. Anybody with any kind of abdominal pain, whether it's explained or unexplained, will at times use that abdominal pain to serve some purpose in their life. So anybody with any kind of illness is a malingerer from time to time. But there's no reason to expect that kids who have unexplained signs and symptoms are any more malingering than any of the rest of us. So what's happening is that young people are learning to use their, in this case, physical symptoms, but in the other examples that I've described, they can learn to use their symptoms in order to lessen their level of distress. So to come back to the boy with the language disorder, the consequence of not being able to understand what the teacher says for this boy was that he felt stupid. And feeling stupid is one of the most unpleasant experiences you can give a bright pre-adolescent boy. And so in order to deal with feeling stupid, the horrible disarousing effect of feeling stupid, he learnt, and again, not on any kind of cognitive level, but just by association, he learnt that if he played the fool and people laughed at him, he could reinterpret the arousal that he was feeling in a much more positive way. It still wasn't particularly pleasant for him. It still felt a bit uncomfortable. But now, when the teacher spoke in a complex way to him, and he felt over-aroused and in a horrible way, he could play the fool, and then kids would laugh at him, and he'd feel over-aroused in a slightly less horrible way. And by the nature of these things, this began to generalize, and so that he became the class clown. But also, here was a bright boy who wasn't paying attention in class and was jumping around all over the place. So he got a diagnosis of ADHD. But if we think about this in terms of coping with his over-arousal, you can see that he doesn't actually have any problems with attending. He can attend, but he's using different strategies that override his capacity to attend. Because if we think about attention, let me just talk about attention for a moment. People will say to me, this boy's got no problems with his attention because he can sit in front of a PlayStation for 2 hours uninterrupted. That kind of attention is very low grade. It doesn't require very strong attentional skills to sit in front of a computer for a long period of time because the computer games are designed to capture our attention. What does require a higher level attentional skill is to be able to selectively attend to things. And that measures our capacity to be able to attend to things that aren't the most interesting or dominant things that are happening at the time. So if you think about a child in a classroom who's got all kinds of interesting things happening in their head, there's something fun happening outside the window, the kid next to them is doing something amusing. Even in those circumstances, at least some kids are able to pay attention to what the teacher's saying, which is much less interesting and engaging than all of those other things. And how do they do that? Because they're practicing selective attention. Selective attention is the valuable skill from the point of view of attention in terms of learning in a classroom environment. And therefore, it's something that is very positive in that environment. But if you're very good at selective attention in the jungle, and that means that you're taking a very close look at a flower while there's a saber-toothed tiger behind you, it's not going to be good for your survival. You're going to get eaten. And so when we look at children's attentional capacity in the classroom, we need to ask ourselves, is this child feeling safe? Because if they are feeling safe in the classroom, and we'd like all children to feel safe in the classroom, but unfortunately not all of them do, then selective attention is the appropriate strategy. But if the young person is feeling frightened or distressed or worried about something, then selective attention is not what you need. It's constant vigilance, looking from all angles to see where the threat's coming from next. So if we think about the second boy, the one with who might be labelled with depression, who's preoccupied with his previous traumatic experiences, he doesn't feel safe in the classroom. He is subject to, with little reminders, to be thrown back into the detention centre where he saw violent acts being perpetrated and to be overwhelmed by the distress that goes with that. And you can't expect him to pay attention in class under those circumstances. Just coming back to the notion of communicating the predicament. There are only a limited number of ways in which boys can tell us that things aren't right in their life. One of them is in words. It's great when somebody can say to me, look, my parents bicker all the time and I can't bear it, and it's giving me a guts ache. But that doesn't happen very often. Usually, my task is to try to decode the communication. It'd be interesting to see whether this is in sympathy with or against what you were saying before, Miles, because in my view, there is value for an adult, whether it's a teacher, a parent, or a therapist, to be able to put into words something that the boy himself is not putting into words. And, you know, so really the four little vignettes that I've described really almost exhaust the number of ways in which kids can tell us that something's wrong in their life. And we can put labels on those things relatively easily. And I could probably sort just about every patient I see into one of those four categories. By just looking with my searchlight for those things that I know go to constitute those diagnoses, to go through the tick list of the 15 things you need to get a diagnosis of ADHD or the 9 things that you need to get a diagnosis of depression. What I want to argue is that the really interesting information that we're going to find out about somebody is in the shadows, and just collecting information about symptoms isn't going to actually illuminate things. If we search with our spotlight, we can sort people into categories, we can make diagnoses. If we lurk in the shadows, we get people's stories. And the capacity to get boys to tell stories, I think, is something that is an absolute educational priority. Just to digress for a moment, one of the things that I worry about in our attempt to make schools into more emotionally positive environments are programs like Mind Matters, which go into schools to teach kids about mental health. And to add mental health or emotional well-being to the curriculum. Now, in my view, the educational curriculum is exactly what children need in order to become emotionally more healthy. The same kind of skills that we attempt to facilitate the development of in educating children, enhancing their imagination, helping them to understand and make sense of experience and be able to tell stories, make sense of stories, learn about different genres of narrative and recount and so on. These skills are just exactly what we need in order to be resilient from a mental health and emotional well-being point of view. And so what we should be investing in terms of strengthening the capacity of schools to strengthen children is making better schools, not making hospitals out of schools. And I'll come back to talk about that because people much more knowledgeable than me have said roughly the same thing. If I go into my assessment of these four boys that I've told you about, looking for what's common, all I'll find is that list of symptoms that the Woman's Weekly could just as well find for me. What informs me is what's different about the different individuals that I see. So let me give you an example. We see most of the kids in South Australia who attempt suicide come to our hospital. And amongst girls who attempt suicide, the most common reason is that they've broken up with their boyfriend. And we never accept that as an explanation for why somebody's attempted suicide, just because hundreds of girls break up with their boyfriend every day. And so there must be something more going on. Now, if we think about two girls who present on a given day, having taken an overdose, both saying that they've broken up with their boyfriend, both presenting similar symptoms of moderately severe depression, both having taken a reasonably dangerous overdose. By recognising those common features for those two girls, I'm nowhere along the path of learning how to manage and work with them. It's not until I begin to understand what's different and unique to that individual. So if in the process of talking to one of the girls, I discover that her father and mother divorced when she was two, that her father disappeared from her life for 7 or 8 years, that he then recontacted her when she was about 10 or 11, that she was very wary of him, that they gradually built a relationship. And then about 6 months ago, he got moved into state on business, and at about this time she formed her first serious relationship with a boy, and then now the boy's dropped her. Then suddenly it all makes sense. We can understand why this particular girl has become suicidal after the ordinary developmental experience of breaking up with a boyfriend. And I think I've already sort of laboured this point, that what we need to do is stop thinking about the way in which young people present to us as dysfunctional and to see it as adaptive. That doesn't mean it works. That doesn't mean that an outside person looking at the behaviour would judge this to be appropriate behaviour or in the child's best interest. The boy with a language disorder who's playing the class clown, that's not in his best interest educationally or otherwise. But it's his adaptation, it's his best attempt to make things work for himself. We associate, through our kind of, boys do conform to gender stereotypes and they give us more anger than they give us of the feelings along the bottom of that triangle. And so I want to say a little bit about that. I want to talk about how confused young people can get about their feelings. That's not very controversial. But here I'm not talking about conflicts about identity or other cognitive confusion. I'm talking about confusion on a more or less somatic level. What am I actually feeling at the moment? What is my gut feeling? And people get that wrong. So if you just reflect on yourself for a moment and think about your own management of anger, fear, and sadness, you probably will concede that at least that one of those feelings is a bit more difficult for you than the others. Either you're not as comfortable with it in yourself, or you don't like to see it in other people, or you come from a cultural background where it's a bit unacceptable or something like that. And here I'm particularly talking about anger, fear, and sadness. I add shame, particularly in the setting of the medical setting, both mental illness and physical illness, because shame is an emotion that boys often carry if they've got some kind of medical or some kind of physical or mental impairment. If you as sophisticated adults sometimes don't feel comfortable in one of those areas, you can bet that most kids aren't completely comfortable or fluent or aware of those three feelings. And what happens a lot with boys is that anger becomes the substitute for other feelings. The softer feelings at the bottom get held down, and anger comes out as being acceptable. And so, for example, I might see somebody from a very abusive background who's had an objectively frightening childhood, who tells me, when asked, what sort of things make you frightened? Nothing. I don't know what it's like to feel scared. And so what you see sometimes in such young people is panic, but panic that manifests itself with aggressive behaviour. The person gets anxious, they misinterpret the arousal that comes with that as rage, and they enact that rage. As clinicians, as teachers, as parents, on average, we're better at responding to people who manifest the softer feelings on the bottom of the triangle rather than those who come at us in an angry fashion. And so part of our work as adults in dealing with potentially angry young people is to be able to translate anger into other feelings, or to make sense of anger in a slightly different way. And so from this point of view, I think that it's important to distinguish between two different kinds of anger. Street anger and nursery anger, I want to call them. Street anger, you're walking down the road and somebody's behaving in an aggressive fashion. You know, get away from my girlfriend, or get out of my way, or something like that. And our response to that is appropriately a kind of fight-flight response. We do get out of their way, generally speaking. Then put yourself in the situation, and so the message that's being sent out by that person through their street anger is go away or get out of my way. Let's now go to the nursery. An infant that's been crying, maybe because it's hungry or wet or uncomfortable, and nobody's responded, and now it's crying in an angry fashion. It's roaring with what you can only describe as rage. Now, we wouldn't want our response to that to be fight or flight, would we? That would end up with somebody making a notification about child abuse. What we recognise is that there's a different message from that infant in the nursery. If that infant could speak in mature adult language, it would say to us something like, look, I cried politely to tell you that I was hungry and you didn't give me any attention, and now I'm completely overwhelmed by feelings that I can't possibly manage. This is an emergency. I need you here right now to make things right for me. And so the response that we have to anger in the nursery is to run in and help, to intervene in a positive way. And learning to do that learning to set aside that kind of fight-flight response is something that the most deprived and dysfunctional parents that we see don't have. They fail to be able to do that. And we see that as children grow up, we begin to see that pervade the system. So just this morning, the emergency mental health nurse was handing over to me a patient, 10-year-old boy, very deprived background, abusive background, sitting in class with his hoodie over his head. And the teacher said, "It's a rule in this class, you don't have your hood over your head." And he just kind of grunted and didn't do anything. And you can predict what happened. Complete escalation. Police are called. He's dragged into the as an end result of a lot of activities. He's dragged into the emergency department. So, you know, here's the classical response to inappropriately angry behaviour. In this case, quite passively angry behaviour. It escalates, and you know, we've responded to it as though it's street anger, when in fact it's very much nursery anger that's been misrecognized. Okay. I want to talk now about these two interventions that we have for naughty boys. Stimulants and behaviour therapy, and why I don't like either of them very much. If we look at the scientific evidence about stimulants, they have a short-term benefit, but they don't improve in the medium to long-term any of the things that we really care about. And taking stimulants in the long-term doesn't do you any good, and it may do you some harm, so that in summary, there's no grounds for anything but short-term use of stimulants. What?
You can leave it right there. You can summarise that.
One of the many inaccurate things that Pat McGorry has said, Pat McGorry, for those of you who don't know, is last year's Australian of the Year and owns psychiatry in Australia. One of the things that he said on radio in Adelaide last week is that I'm ideologically opposed to the use of psychiatric medication. That's not in fact the case. But what I do practice is what Joanna Moncrief, a British psychiatrist, describes as drug-centred in contrast to disease-centred prescribing. There's no such thing as antidepressant or antipsychotic drugs or anti-ADHD drugs in the same way that there are antibiotics. Antibiotics are antibiotics because they kill bacteria. Antidepressants don't kill depression, they don't treat depression. What we have are a range of psychotropic drugs, that is, drugs that affect the brain, in more or less predictable ways. So most people who take stimulant drugs will have the same response to them. Whether or not they've got a disorder, you have decreased purposeless movement and you have increased concentration and attention. And so there are situations in medicine where there's a good match between the profile of a drug and the profile of problems that the person has. And if we can find a drug that matches the person's difficulties, and if the harms of giving the person that drug are outweighed by the potential benefits, the potential harms and the potential benefits, then it would be a good decision to use that drug. And there are certainly situations in medicine where that seems like a good investment. The so-called antipsychotic drugs, which have a terrible numbing effect on our emotions and our thinking, that's a bad thing to do if you're functioning normally, but if you've got all kinds of crazy destructive thoughts leading to all kinds of crazy destructive behaviour, then you will medicate that with those drugs, and that makes sense. That's a good medical decision. But in the vast majority of cases of children with the four presentations that I've talked about, there isn't there either isn't a good match between the pattern of effects that you can expect the drug to have and the pattern of problems that the person has, or more commonly, we can't be convinced that the benefits are going to outweigh the harms. And yet we persist with using drugs, and data doesn't seem to make a difference. And I think John Kenneth Galbraith told us why that might be. Why not behaviour therapy? The kind of behaviour therapy that we use in medicine and in education centres around the interpretation of learning theory that comes under the heading of operant conditioning. Now, operant conditioning and classical conditioning are really probably different ways of describing the same thing, but using a mental framework that is informed by operant conditioning, this is the kind of bad way of doing it, and using the mental framework that is informed by classical conditioning, that's the good way of doing it. So that clearly is an oversimplification, but that's the argument that I want to put forward. And the idea, one of the things that I really hate, and there are lots of things I hate, but one of the things I really hate is the idea that we can have rewards without punishments. And rewards and punishments are just the opposite sides of the coin. The denial of taking a reward away is a punishment, taking a punishment away is a reward. So you can't have rewards without punishments, and just calling punishments consequences doesn't get rid of it either. So how does operant conditioning work? Well, it makes people try harder. And so if we put the boy with the language disorder onto a star chart and we give him rewards for when he behaves well in class, and we don't give him rewards or punish him when he doesn't behave well in class, that might, if we're lucky, get him to try harder, and he might succeed. And if he does, this is when the real effective intervention kicks in. He gets a sense of mastery. And having got that sense of mastery, he's got a strong incentive to keep doing what you want him to do. And you keep putting his stars up on the wall, and he thinks, okay, might as well humour them. But the star charts are more for the adults than they are for the kids. But trying to change somebody's behaviour by getting them to try harder is undermined by two possible circumstances that are almost universal amongst the kids that I see. The first one is, this kid's already trying as hard as he can. And so if you give him incentives to try harder, all you're going to do is humiliate him, because you're going to give him an increased sense of failure because he tries harder and he still fails. The second scenario that undermines rewards and punishments is that the kid has got better things to think about. The boy who's traumatised by his experience in immigration detention has got all kinds of reward and punishment, mainly punishment chemicals flooding around in his brain. Your little star chart's not going to cut the mustard with that. You're only just playing around on the edges of it. So here's Pavlov's dog, and people will be familiar with the fact that the dog learned to associate the sound of a bell with the fact that it was going to be fed, and so therefore it would salivate with that stimulus. And this is how we learn. We learn by association. And sometimes that's a positive thing, but sometimes it's a negative thing, because we learn to associate, we associate a lot of extraneous stuff to something that's toxic to us. And so if we've got a scary thought, we can put it out of our mind. But in the process of putting the scary thought out of our mind, we put a whole pile of other stuff out of our minds as well. And so what happens is that we get into patterns of avoidance. So the boy with the language disorder doesn't just avoid the situation where the teacher is giving long speeches in the classroom. He comes to avoid a whole pile of other situations and becomes frightened. And that gets reinforced, because avoidance is rewarding. This is so-called negative reinforcement. If you avoid something that feels bad, it makes you feel better. And so you avoid it more the next time. So the person with agoraphobia, they walk towards the door, they feel bad. They walk back towards the lounge room, they feel better. So what are you going to do? You're going to stay back here. So what's the difference between operant and classical conditioning? The classical paradigm contains meaning. It leaves space for meaning. Operant conditioning is mindless. And you ask the question, what's this child avoiding? And then as adults or therapists, we have two possible responses. If what he's avoiding is the fact that mum and dad are, you know, there's domestic violence, then there's no point in trying to help him to change. We've got to intervene to try to end the domestic violence. If, on the other hand, it's something that he has the wherewithal to deal with, like the boy with the language disorder, then we might want to make changes to the system in which he's operating, but it might be more about helping him to make changes that involve not being rewarded or punished for various kinds of behaviour, but gradually overcoming his fear and avoidance. And again, we get to the sense of mastery, which is the real payoff. So I'm now on my last section. The Australian Bureau of Statistics tells us that one in four young Australians have a mental disorder. Now, in fact, that's a misleading statement, because really what they found was that one in four young Australians had a mental disorder in the last 12 months, or have it now. And the problem we find when authorities make statements and perhaps unwittingly put a spin on them is that other authorities then take those statements and translate them into something else, which is quite destructive. So it goes from the fact that one in four young Australians have a mental disorder to translate it into a number, which is even more scary, and it says they're currently locked out of mental health care that they desperately need. So this has been translated from a survey which might show that the person engages in occasional binge drinking or that they're sad, through to the fact that they're locked out of mental health care that they desperately need. And you can see the problem. There are a number of implications in here. First, the first implication is that conventional mental health care is going to be helpful to these kids and their families. And the second is that they actually want it at all. And so just now to come to the fourth of my vignettes, which I haven't really talked about yet, the boy who's experiencing what might be a pre-psychotic phenomenon. And this country has just invested over $1 billion in the early psychosis approach. And I feel like if Wayne Swan was to pick up this document, he might feel like a superannuation fund manager who had just invested a third of his portfolio in Lehman Brothers and picked up the New York Times the next day. Cochrane Review, which is the kind of highest order of analysis of psychological information, is giving a pretty lukewarm report to the whole idea of early intervention for psychosis. It's not saying it's a waste of time or that it's destructive. But, if this was a Moody's rating, it would be kind of C+ maybe. And we've just invested most of our mental health dollars into this intervention. At the potential cost of not trying to understand the boy with the potentially psychotic experiences, where he's coming from, what that might be a reaction to, but just feeding him into the factory where he's going to get this not very well evidence-supported intervention. And one of the real problems in mental health and the whole approach to mental health prevention for boys and young men is this mistake of conflating two populations. There are 1 to 2% of boys and young men who have severe disabling mental disorders, you can spot these kids at the bus stop. You don't need to carry out sophisticated assessments, and they demand sophisticated mental health interventions. And we certainly don't get it right with all of these kids by any means. We could do a lot better with them. But they do require expert mental health interventions. But they're not the same as the 20 to 25% who are identified in population surveys as having some form of mental disorder. Now, I don't want to, for a minute, diminish the distress and suffering that those children and young people might be feeling and the effect that might have on them and their community. I'm not saying that we should dismiss that in any way. What I'm saying is that there's no evidence that the mental health system does any better with those kids than a whole range of other possible interventions, whether it's general practice or general counselling or nothing at all, or talking to their mates. And there are a whole pile of things that we can do that might make a difference to those young people, but one of them isn't proselytising for them to come into the mental health system. So if it was possible to engage in trading of international experts, I'd want to repatriate Sir Michael Marmot from the UK, where even conservative governments are listening to his message about the need to institute social change to make a difference to mental health. And Marmot says what other people have been saying, but he says it with a great deal more authority and evidence, well packaged, that we must invest in infancy. We must invest in parents. Some of you may need to cover your eyes for the next slide because it's quite shocking. If we look at this population here, these are the infants at 22 months who are doing best. And if you look at those who come from high socioeconomic background and you follow them until they're age 10, they'll do what we'd expect them to do, regress towards the mean. But look, here's the population who started out in every way equivalent to that population, but they came from a low socioeconomic status. Look what happens. By the time they're of age 10, they've been crossed in terms of their development by the people who started out worst but had a high socioeconomic status and finished up here. If you look at the second of Marmot's assessments, here he looks at the value of education and the importance of education in determining our health. And look at this. This is if you've got no qualifications. This is all illnesses, not just mental illnesses, but mental and physical illnesses. And the percent who are ill all the way between the age of 16 to 74 approaches 30%. And you can see that it's less than half in those who've got tertiary level education. Now, of course, this isn't simple cause and effect, because people with worse health will drift in this direction. Nevertheless, it's quite a striking graph. So what does that mean? And it's the same for mental health as it is for physical health. What does that mean about trying to intervene to improve the mental health of the community? It means you don't invest in mental health. You invest in education. But what does that look like? If we took the $1 billion or $2 billion that we've just invested in mental health in this country, which is a dramatic, I don't know how many percent it is increase, but it's a dramatic increase. If we took it out of mental health and put it into education, it'd be a drop in the bucket, because education is a much more expensive thing to engage in than mental health. And so we don't do that. You can see politically why it's much more exciting to put the money into mental health than it is into education, because nobody's even going to notice if you put it into education. And so we've got a Prime Minister who's committed to improving education and has done some quite good things in that direction. But, you know, even in those circumstances, she's not going to have the courage or the support to make the kind of investment into education so that, you know, day of all days, you might need a higher tertiary score to get into teaching than you do to get into commerce. That where society might value education to the point where we pay teachers a higher rate than we pay, you know, kids who move money around in the financial market. And there are a range of other recommendations that Marmot makes and that have been, to some extent at least, bought by a conservative government. And this is my final slide, which is just to look at the issue of obesity. And, you know, for a couple of reasons, really. First, to highlight that, you know, there's no separation to be made between physical health and mental health, and obesity is possibly the best demonstration of that. What's impressive about this graph, which you can see the top line is showing those the level of obesity in those who are most deprived socioeconomically, and the bottom line in those who are most privileged. What impresses me about the graph is not the fact that overall it separates in the way that it does, but how orderly it is, how across 9 different jurisdictions in the UK, in every single jurisdiction, there's an orderly progression between how you do if you come from the most privileged circumstances and how you do if you come from the least privileged circumstances. Thank you. I'm going to stop there.